Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our regular Monday stream. This is, I guess, the last of our guest streams for a little while.
It will be, yes.
Fitting as it is, well, this isn't the last stream of March, but I guess it's the second to last stream of March. So it's been a guest-heavy March, but we've enjoyed it. Some of you may remember him, some of you may have seen him in person. He's a very good public speaker and a decent friend of the channel. Say hello, Mr. Panama Hat.
Hello there. Good evening, everyone. And yes, I've been watching some of the recent streams. Very, very much enjoyed them, as always. I especially like the one on the Hope Not Hate report, just because it was kind of poignantly funny. I really hadn't realized how low that they had come in their own hierarchy, and how bad they actually are at getting any info on people. I really like your exposure of their promotion of one academic agent, basically, where they just wrote a sort of CV statement for him. So,
They're going through the mo even they like they seem bored by their own existence, but that's
yeah.
oh man, that seems to be a lot of the weird NGO net stuff we've noticed. It seems to be like groaning under its own weight
And
almost.
don't hold your breath, because there's going to be more of
Yeah.
yeah.
Don't take your meds. You'll love this next shadow person.
Yeah, no, exactly.
But yes,
And
thank you.
I don't want to derail this. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, I've gone. No, please continue.
Oh, sorry. I don't know if there was a bit of delay there. I don't want to derail the stream too early, but I can't help r resisting mentioning the momentous news that has come down to us from Scotland.
Oh, I have to admit, I don't know what you're talking about. I have absolutely no idea. It totally escapes me.
Hamza Hoosef?
Yeah, who?
Who?
Sorry, never heard of him, mate.
Sounds like he makes
Well,
a shit curry, to be honest, but
yeah, I think it will actually be relevant because I notice, of course, now that England and Scotland is Ireland as well? No, I don't know. Run by, shall we say, subcontinentals. Which strikes me as, yeah, ironic. But it will come up because, of course, one of the poems that we will talk about today is the Ballad of the White Horse about Alfred resisting foreign invasion. So
Yes.
I think that'll be relevant today.
They're certainly sub something.
Anyway, I shall make sure we get it out of the way just now, and we shall thank the people who turn up for the streams
Yes.
and engage with the chat and do the super chats and donate to what is currently the PayPal at the moment, I believe.
Yes, there are our non-Google link still is the PayPal. I cannot get Entropy to work for the life of
I
me.
mean, you could also, if you choose to support us on Substack as well, because I noticed someone gave us one of the founders things at some point last month, and I must have missed it. So whoever you are, big thank you for that.
Yes, we also do write on the Substack. There will be a piece out there on Thursday. We're trying to keep it weekly. It was bi-weekly for a while, but we
Other things take
yeah,
precedence.
we that was more of a bonus than anything. Our content generally is on Mondays in terms of the primary stream, and Thursdays on the Substack. That is the way it's kind of been and will be. It will occasionally be substituted for Tuesdays if things are, ready in a bit of advance. And we do also, at the moment, do a Wednesday stream as well, but that is, again, kind of a bonus thing since we have so much to get through. But today, we just thought we'd get Mr. Panama Hat on to have a bit of a gab about the book that I should not refer to it as your book, as you said, because
No,
you.
it's Panama Hat's book, I've
It's Panama.
decided.
We've decided it's Panama Hat's book, but you don't actually
Just,
get royalties for it.
I will say I've just switched to my phone because the internet on the PC was too unreliable.
Oh, fair
Is
enough.
the sound still okay?
You sound a little bit like on a phone, but I'm just hopefully you didn't blow
Okay.
people's ears out there.
Yeah,
I've turned you down a
apologies.
bit.
But yes, if you were to buy a copy of Imperium Anthology of English Verse,
Yes.
edited by one Benjamin Affer, you will find a small picture of a frog inside, I presume, is the sort of brief profile on yourself as a tweed wearing, pipe smoking man of the previous century or so.
Man, a frog. I've
Oh
actually got
no,
the nice kind of 3D
it's
image here too. I can flash.
ooh.
Ooh.
no, No, it's not really my book. I merely wrote the introduction and helped edit some of the selections, and spent many weeks arguing the case that some poems should or shouldn't be included. And of course, because we wanted the book to be pocket sized, we didn't want to bring out this massive tome. We wanted it to be something that you could just sort of carry around with you, like a sort of slice of you know, a slice of our past and our culture, sort of in your pocket. So that meant, of course, we couldn't include everything we wanted to, and we, you know, argued and, you know, spilled ink and shed tears and so forth. but no, many, I'm very happy with how it turned out now.
Many bowls of Sutcliffe creme brulee pipe tobacco spilled.
Yeah, if you're in the US, that's available probably cheapest on the Imperium Press website. If you're in the UK, I believe that is available on Amazon.
Is that how much they're wanting for the paperback on Amazon?
On Amazon, yeah.
Well, you might be cheaper to just suck up for the shipping for Imperium.
Yeah, it seems to be that the better place to get it is Imperium Press. But how did this come about then? Just a brief kind of introduction to how you ended up editing a book on English verse.
Well, a gentleman called Mike, I only know him as Mike, who I believe runs or at least works for Imperium Press, originally had the idea for bringing out sort of a dissident rights own anthology of great poetry, because he's sort of, you know, he wants the dissident right to develop its own, you know, kind of cultural senses and, you know, have a better understanding of arts and these sorts of things that are very important to who Western Europeans are as a people, I suppose. And he originally reached out to the well-known Mr. John Dee about it. And John Dee referred him to me because he thought I would be better suited for it. So I received a message about that sometime last summer, I think around May, June. And then it was agreed that I would write a 6,000-word introduction to the book and help edit and choose which poems went in, sort of make a long list and then a short list, etc., that kind of thing. So the introduction is actually quite lengthy, and it's really more of an essay on why poetry matters to us, and why it sort of more broadly why art matters to us, I suppose, because it's been a question I've thought about a lot more since Sargon asked me at the last Shildings event. He said, "Well, can you give me an answer?" Sort of, well, you know, so say somebody says, "Well, I don't care about poetry; it's all, you know, pointless and poncy and whatever." You know, what answer would you give? And I sort of said, "Well, you have to remember that a lot of this poetry is all part of the same continuum from the kind of great epics and epic sort of epic storytelling and epic verse and sort of musical traditions that are the kind of almost the founding blocks of a people, really. That kind of poetry and the arts as a whole are in a sense the blood that the sort of the blood or the trace that people leave behind them as they go through history.
Yes, you know, the fact kind of, that in the sense that De Maistre talks about, you could see it as sort of the retelling of myths and stories and legends that don't require modern day literacy as we think about it. Not to totally upend where you are, but I think for a little bit of context on the stream, because I know it's certainly where I'm coming from, and it will very much be where a number of people raised in Britain in the last 20 or so years will be coming from as well, is that try as I might, I struggle not to just roll my eyes when people bring up something about poetry, because frankly, the introduction I got to poetry in school was Carol Ann Duffy. Oh, poet laureate to the Queen. Oh, that'll be all interesting. And what she actually... what she wrote was dry, quasi-feminist trite that was extremely off-putting, that meant when we sort of then looked at some more interesting stuff like sonnets from Shakespeare, that I was like, well, this is cool and all, but it's not as cool as like the, you know, Caesar and Midsummer Night's Dream and Macbeth, because the form I associate with poetry is associated with this dry feminist shit.
Yeah.
So for me, it's very much something I would like to, you know, unplug myself from that, as it were, and re-understand poetry, and more specifically verse, as you're talking about it there, you know, a complete reflection of myth telling, story that connects back, you know, who knows how many thousands of years in some sense.
Yes, I mean, I think we'll definitely talk more about the problem with modern poetry and modern education, and what I would refer to as the court poets, people like Carol Ann Duffy, who are kind of they have this paradoxical situation of being extremely kind of socially transgressive, but also being a part of the regime, sort of very much at the heart of the establishment. You know, we'll talk about that. I mean, I will say, if there's a silver lining to that story you told, you know, it's very wonderful that you instinctively rejected the works of someone like Carol Ann Duffy, you know? even if you weren't more broadly interested. It's just, you know, you can tell from the beginning that, you know, some types of modern art are just inferior, I think.
Yes.
It is quite a difficult thing to get into, because it has deliberately, I believe, been hobbled and is displayed as poncy. I don't think it was even... We did get the Carolyn Duffy stuff as well, because she was poet laureate for ages, wasn't she? But yeah, we also, looking back on it now and remembering, even in like primary school, we must have been some of the first people to get like the NGO syllabus style stuff. Because in year six, we were being given like weird refugee poems and you know, African verse, and it was all very bizarre, and even the teachers seemed to not quite understand why we were doing it.
What we got was so much worse though, because obviously in Scotland, almost to some extent, I think because of Gaelic and other kind of things, has an almost even richer and more obvious history with poetry.
Yes,
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is Robert Burns.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we got some of the weird NGO stuff and Robert Burns thrown in.
So
it all becomes so confusing. And I think, not to, you know, go on a whole different sideline, that actually there is like in a way that Gunon talks about in Reign of Quantity and Sign of the Times, that through art being materialized, you know, we experience it in youth in these really poor forms, you know, with Carol Ann Duffy and terrible modern art, and look at this, you know, photograph gallery of these people coming across, you know, the Mediterranean Sea, and woe is them. They used to have that one up in the uni I was in.
Yeah.
And then what happens is you end up essentially rejecting all art. And that, I think, is the attitude, you know, the sort of people who would be like, haha, well, you know, the Dali mini thing is funny because it puts shitlib artists at jobs, and who cares about art? That's for toffs and weirdos. It's like, no, as you said earlier on, Hat, you know, it isn't even necessarily books and, you know, treaties that will get us out of what we are in. It'll be great works. It will be art. It will be verse. It will be statues, architecture, whatever it is. And that to understand that, you have to understand at least something about art, but they are just so determined to drill into us the worst forms of it so that we reject it wholesale.
In my opinion, I completely agree. It's the reason that children are basically taught badly. They're taught bad art badly. And it's a deliberate sort of cultural bomb, I think, because it creates a total disconnect and disinterest in a kind of cultural history of the place and the people that you come from, which of course makes for very docile kind of cattle if you're from the point of view of the sort of the regime, if you like. And I think that, as I said, it's being done deliberately. In order to foster that, it's very odd because, as far as I can tell, there have been two types of sort of civilization, and then ours is a third. So if you go back before the industrial age, every country, every people had epics and kind of national epics and sort of what I would call poetry of the commons, you know, the verse that everybody knows, whether they're literate or not, you know. And because very often people prior to the industrial age either couldn't read or didn't have access to books or both, these poems, these songs would be taught, would be sort of passed down orally. You know, you would, people would sit around and hear them recited, and then they would learn them by way of that and be able to recite them, and they would be passed on and passed on. And this is still around in some places. I know that AA talks about in Persia, which is a country very steeped in the poetic, its own poetic traditions, that even today you can walk down the streets of a city or in the country and ask people, and they will be able to recite huge chunks of ancient Persian poetry, you know, huge chunks of all that kind of stuff, because it's passed on still, you know, it's part of life there. You learn the songs and the poems of your people as you sort of come of age, as you begin to realize who and what you are, I suppose.
Sorry, this was common. Sniggering briefly, Scrup has up a thing here, poetry by heart, which seems to be something.
No, it's fine. Continue. Sorry, we just had something to bring up after you'd finished. That's all.
Okay. And then, of course, you have the industrial age in which people are taught to read. But the problem is that teaching everybody in a society to read doesn't mean making everybody literate. I mean, I would exactly. argue that now we live in one of the most illiterate ages ever known to man, in terms of how detached everyone is from any kind of good or quality or culturally relevant literature, even though everyone can read in the technical sense of the word. So, you know, there was a brief period from sort of, I'd say, the late Victorian era up to the sort of 60s, 70s, maybe at a push, where you had what I would call a genuinely literate society, in which, you know, someone like T.S. Eliot was able to, you know, be a sort of best-selling poet and have a wide influence. And, you know, all these people like Chesterton and Belloc and Shaw and all these sorts of people, H.G. Wells, back in the Edwardian era, who were genuinely read and appreciated by a large chunk of the population, both upper and lower. And I mean, one example, I won't say too much on it now because we're going to talk about this later down, but Chesterton's epic ballad, the Ballad of the White Horse, was extremely popular among soldiers in the First World War, just common soldiery who took copies of the book to war with them, bought with their own money, and treasured them, really, really treasured them. They were very, very keen not to lose them and to always have it with them, you know. That, I think, was the sort of brief golden twilight in which you could have a society that hadn't yet been corrupted by the very industrialism it was proliferating. But then you fast forward to now, of course, when, you know, all that kind of stuff has been destroyed, as I said, partly willfully by the regime in order to foster disconnect and confusion. But anyway, sorry.
Oh, no, it's fine. I would just want to have a quick look, actually. I've linked them in the Discord bit as well. About what you get if you look up what the curriculum for poetry is in Britain. So this is kind of our starting point. The Education Hub, National Poetry Day, poetry on the curriculum. There's a lot of waffling here, but it says, since 2013, the department has funded Poetry by Heart to deliver a national poetry recitation competition. Blah, blah, blah. But it says, there is a body of evidence that suggests engaged with poetry can have benefits for mental health, cultural awareness, and self-expression.
Your poetry will be therapeutic.
Well, it's if you look at the timeline of the anthology, and this is for the 11+ I put up on screen here, but it's, you get into the 60s and it's people like Louise Bennett Coverley. I don't know who that is. Colonization in Reverse.
I don't know who that is either, by the way.
Well, let's put it this way. She does look a bit like Aunt Jemima.
Eloise Greenfield, who apparently wrote something about Harriet Tubman in 1978. What does this have to do with British poetry?
But I think not some of the names stand out here, but there's like a Philip Larkin one, James Tate. But then there's also like Gillian Clark, who I'm pretty sure is a feminist of one variety of another. I'm sure if we were to dig into them more so, we would find that a lot of the ones I've got listed here are just paused through and through.
Oh, I just like horrendous, like modern, I took a shit and clapped and you must clap as well.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. I don't know who Valerie Bloom is.
Oh, there's one about Rosa Parks next to it.
Yeah, Rosa Parks, Rita Dove.
That important part of British culture, Rosa Parks.
Sassy black women talking about Rosa Parks, yes.
I mean, I will go on a reactionary rant here and talk about the teaching of poetry in school, because all this waffle about, you know, engaging and self-expression. I mean, one, poetry is not about self-expression. Poetry is about essentially how imaginative a poet can be with language, how inventive a poet can be with language as a tool. Because poetry specifically isn't like being a painter, where you've got a huge range of kind of, you know, physical material to work with and a huge amount of choice in what you actually make, or music, where, you know, you've got whole orchestras and kind of methods. You really, all a poet has is a piece of paper and a pen at the end of the day. That's all you've got to work with. So inventiveness is the key virtue, and the ability to hone down language into something chosen and something beautiful that also seems effortless. So the idea that poetry is like taking a shit, which is what we have now, has done more damage to the art form than practically anything else. You know, where it's just, you know, oh, I'm sad about this, and oh, I'm sad about this, and oh, it's terrible. You know, the result you get from that is what are now called the Instagram poets. You know, the sort of what's her name, Rupi Kaur, and this sort of thing, where it's just platitudes about vaginas with line breaks. You know, it's not poetry, but that is the logical end result of using poetry as a form of what shall I say, sort of rectal clearance. You know, that's basically what it is.
Well, yeah, that's, you're exactly right, because the other end isn't sort of, and dare I use the term, reductive sort of nonsense like that, is just explicitly political. I mean, we're looking at one from some guy called Daljeet Nagra here,
right,
who's written now, some...
I don't mean to interrupt, but I will say, please keep this poem up on the screen while Evelyn is talking, because I have a very specific bone to pick with this poem. Anyway, sorry, go on.
But he's, you know, he's like stowed in the sea to invade the alfresco lash of diesel breeze. He's basically talking about arriving
migrants, yeah.
Yeah, arriving migrants in the back of Bedford vans. I mean, if you scroll down here, what's the bottom, second last one there?
Yeah.
Swarms of us grafting in the black within the shot of the moon's spotlight, banking on the miracle of the sun, span its rainbow, passport us to life. Only then can it be human to hike ourselves barefaced for the clear. Ugh.
Can I also point out the extremely cheap placement trick of making the verses look like waves?
Yeah.
Oh no.
Yeah, they've done that. Yeah. He's so smart, guys. Now apparently it's basically a bastardization of another poem by a guy called Matthew Arnold,
which is about soldiers arriving after World War One, I believe.
Yeah, and it's also about, it's a melancholic dialogue of a civilized England imagining the withdrawal of religion from our shores and just sent into conflict and disorder he thinks must follow. And this is basically hit this Daljeet Nagra going, ha ha, we've destroyed England and now we're all going to come here and laugh at you as we dance on its corpse.
Yeah, because they've got this whole like thing at the side, which I would presume if you were to order this as part of the syllabus as a teacher, this is the stuff you would be told to talk about in class.
Yeah, this is run by the government, by the way.
This was on my syllabus. This was on my syllabus when I was in school. I sort of instinctively always was, but I wasn't really that, you know, right wing or sort of political back then. I was kind of mildly grumbly about things like immigration. But this poem really got under my skin, you know. And at the time, I didn't have the sort of the grasp of literature that I could sort of, you know, put it in its place. So I just sort of had to sit there and swallow it. I was really, really just irritated to no end by this, because it was just it's a song celebrating the destruction of one culture by the invaders, you know.
Yes,
really. Yeah.
Well, I think as well about you mentioned,
also a bad poem.
Yeah, it's terrible. The prose is all
you mentioned being poem at Witan. in summer of last year, and obviously I did my speech there on propaganda, and I had this whole kind of wrap up thing at the end about, you know, the first generation sort of northern working family who, or sort of said the work northern working family who's just sent the first generation of theirs sort of lot to university for the first time, and then they come back and, you know, their head's been filled with all sorts of nonsense about how all Western literature is racist or something like that. And then this is perfectly modelled by sort of Maoist forms of propaganda. And then I see, third paragraph there, and explore the poem. Consider how the immigrants are described. Stowed in the sea and hutched, they try to go under the radar. They are doing something dangerous, fearing a stab in the back or being caught in the spotlight of the moon. Niagara also uses the sort of metaphors employed insidiously by racists to whip up fear of immigration. He imagines that immigrants invade in dehumanized swarms.
Yeah, it's basically you are being de-radicalized by bad poetry that is quite literally a celebration of the destruction of a previous England. It's so explicit is the thing. The fact that it's taken from In Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold. And he basically just says that, says, look, this poem has no regard for Britain. It is a parody of a previous era and a previous man who imagined what the death of religion would bring to these shores and the violence that the lack of an inner spiritual life would do. And now he's talking, you know, he's cleverly quipping about the fact that a large part of the British population regard huge amount of immigrants invading as an invasion. And you are meant, again, it's just so steeped in everything, and it very much is kind of an example of poetry is so unpopular because it has just become a demonstration of hegemony. It's just a tool of reinforcing what the regime is, and that's why people can't see beauty in it anymore, and that's why public is basically disengaged from it. So yeah.
Shall I point out that the awards that this man has received involve an MBE, a fellowship of the Royal Society, and various captured awards like the T.S. Eliot Prize, National Poetry Prize, the Costa Poetry Award, the Guardian First Book Award. You know, or if you write a victory song for the regime as it tramples over the native culture of its land, you will be fated. You know, fated as a great bard. You know, it's like that old cliche. When, you know, some barbarian king would take over a kingdom and then instruct all the poets to write endless songs praising him, you know, for his brave, glorious deeds. It's that kind of thing.
Niagara, sing me another verse about how Dover's amazing now that it's filled with huddled immigrants.
Yes, Chairman Sunak.
But we should probably get on to some of the examples, since this is a not a moaning stream.
I was going
to
say, things can only get better.
Yes, things can only get better.
I want to just add a little bit more about this, because, you know, the reason that they're pushing all of these kind of media. I mean, this is the thing that really gets me more than anything. I suppose this is somewhat petty, but it's not even just that they're pushing what is really foreign and quite caustic poetry onto the culture, a culture which has a deeply ingrained poetic tradition. And I mean, you know, England, Scotland and Wales all in that. It's not even good poetry. Like this is a very bad poem that we're looking at here from a technical point of view. You know, objectively, there's nothing I can really praise about it. You know, I mentioned the cheap trick of the making the verses look like waves, which seems designed for a kind of disinterested 14-year-old GCSE student to go, this represents the Dover Sea as it comes onto the, you know,
yeah.
it's pure curriculum bait, really, you know, definitely written with that in mind. And it's the fact that, you know, as I think this touches on the point about Carol Ann Duffy at the beginning, it's not even that you're being taught foreign poetry per se. It's you're being taught anti-poetry.
Yes,
you're being taught something with the purpose of which is to snap your connection with the lifeblood of what came before you. Really,
It is. I think anti-poetry is a great way to describe it. And you're right. It's very much the waves represent the waves on the Dover Beach and also the waves of people coming to the border.
Yeah.
I have read the GTC syllabus.
GTC fodder. Yeah.
Hello. My name is Russell.
Before we get on to the first poem, we do have the Geezer 30, who's chucked as a tenor. Evening, folks. Does Hat have an opinion on Algernon Charles Swinburne? Also for the host, an introduction to proper poetry and Swinburne's Loch Torridon, please do check it out.
I mean, I don't have like just an opinion on him. I mean, you know, he was a very, very important poet. You know, obviously, I read his work. I admire his works. He's not one of my personal kind of favorites that springs to mind per se, but I still very much admire him. I mean, it's kind of like asking somebody, you know, well, what's your opinion of, you know, Peter Paul Rubens as a painter? You know, it's like, well, you know, they obviously have an important place in the canon, to use that controversial word, but I can't really say, oh, I hate Swindon, or oh, I love Swinburne. I do hate Swindon.
No, you must be decisive. There can be no indifference.
I would say he was a very great poet who deserves his place.
Fair enough.
I also want to say that this
poem deserves to be in the canon, but a canon, you know, aimed at the sun and then promptly fired it out of it.
Well, the thing is, I mean, I know that kind of the sort of classical liberal Sargon wing of the dissident right will cringe at this, but I'm fully in favor of just like burning regime books.
Yeah,
like, I'd be perfectly happy for this to chuck this on a fire. Like this, you know, all the horrible like semi-literate like Afro poetry we were forced to learn in school. Just
burn Tracy Emin in bed.
Clean them out.
Ooga booga. Wash chicken. Yeah. Ooga booga.
That's what it is just a humiliation.
Like you said, it's like, I mean, we were forced to do, you know, Benjamin Zephaniah, you know, we were taught that he was like the greatest living poet, essentially, you know, by these kind of middle-aged women teachers who, you know, probably have some sort of weird complex about hip men from the Caribbean. I really don't get it, because again, it's the poetry itself is technically appalling. You know, it's these people can't write poetry. They don't, and the worst thing is that the establishment and the media and all the various public bodies that would be that are meant to be judges of this kind of thing, they have no integrity. They're willing to give awful poetry awards because it fits the narrative, like the one we just looked at. Doesn't matter how bad the poem is, if it panders to them, if it flatters them, if it tells them what the kind of liberal bleeding heart Hay on Wye visiting Guardian reading types who mediate all this want to hear, it will be lauded. And I also just want to draw attention to someone called William Dudley in chat, because they mentioned the former professor of poetry at Oxford, which is like an honorary position. It's a bit like being the laureate, called Sir Geoffrey Hill. And he mentions the point he makes about poetry is not about self-expression, it's about expressiveness. And I basically, that's who I derive that point from, is Sir Geoffrey Hill, who I recommend if people want a sturdier and kind of much more interesting and kind of, I'd say creative introduction to poetry, look up his recorded lectures on YouTube, because he has a wonderful voice and a wonderful, I have to say, autism about words. You know, he was one of these people that owned an 18 volume complete set of the Oxford English Dictionary, you know, and was obsessed with the power and the kind of the structures of the English language as something to be protected. You know, clearly a man who utterly was at odds with the society around him. He died in 2016, I think. Yes, an absolutely fantastic poet and a great lecturer. I'll just point that out before I forget. Anyway, so.
That's fine. I just wanted to say, what is the first? Again, we're kind of doing a bit of an idiot's guide here, but I've called it the beginner's guide. But where would you start? Like you've recommended a couple of poems to us, but where would you say people start with if they really are just lost and the only poems they've read is horrendous regime poetry in their GCSEs? What is the starting point, the bottom floor?
It's difficult because, in a sense, everybody responds slightly differently. So I can't really give a blanket answer, but something that does seem to resonate with people, especially in these circles, would be something like Rudyard Kipling, who is kind of one of these figures who is an entire subject unto himself. You know, he wasn't just a poet, he wasn't just a writer, he was kind of the defining face of the late 1800s, you know, and early 1900s. There's a reason that right now, as we speak, there are classrooms full of Indian academics somewhere in the subcontinent, you know, discussing if Kipling should be remembered as an Indian poet or not, you know, this kind of thing. And I think because he not only had a connection with English history and kind of had the talent of a writer to be able to speak for the English as a people, which he really does. If the English have ever had a voice in the last few centuries, it has to have been Kipling, I think. And he had this great intellectual connection to all these things and to what England was and what it might become. And he was able to create poems which are extraordinarily accessible, because he has a real sense of meter and rhythm, and he really writes songs, strictly speaking, more than poems. You know, every time I open up, I've got a lovely little book of Kipling poems, and every time I open it up, the urge is just to sing them out loud, you know. And I really think for people in this sphere, that if I had to say, here's where you start with Kipling. Buy the Everyman Library Pocket Poets edition. It's a tiny little book, but it's full of his best poems. It's available on Amazon for like, you know, £8 or something. It's not very expensive, and it fits in your back pocket. You can take it anywhere, and it's utterly remarkable. And you know that you can enjoy the poems on a whole number of levels. If you want to be really autistic about it, you can really get into them and see all these details. If you just like a good rollicking rhyme, then he's also best for it, you know. And I think Chesterton falls into that category as well. But the problem with him is that his poems are not properly collected yet, really. They're still a bit scattered. And to be fair, they do vary in quality in a way that I don't think Kipling does. I think Kipling was able to do sort of banger after banger.
Yeah, you can get the hardcover version for about 10 quid, but it's so common you can get used versions for about £1 with like 2 quid delivery. So it is extremely available. I'll probably actually go and
order this
after... oh, awfully scattered. I know.
That poem is fantastic. The poems in that edition are fantastic. And I mean, you know, Kipling is probably one of the most famous and widely read authors to have ever lived. So you can get, you know, old 1940s copies of his collected poems for, you know, £2 in a secondhand bookshop, and it'll have everything in it. You know, it's extraordinarily easy to get into Kipling. And I think that I can't really think of anybody in this sphere. I would include Americans in that too, because Kipling did actually have quite a strong connection to America. I think that honestly, there's no way they couldn't enjoy at least a couple of those poems, you know.
Yeah.
They're songs of an entire people, sometimes through the lens of a kind of comedic character, sometimes through the lens of just a common soldier serving somewhere in the empire, you know. He is the way in for people in this sphere, I think. Fantastic.
What I know about Kipling is he also quite heavily influenced. You mentioned the fact that he's very song-like. He's quite known for heavily influencing some of the kind of Chichester Midland hymns written around the time as well.
Yeah.
A lot of his work is like, I won't say wholesale ripped off, but it very much is that kind of work that is used for that kind of stuff. The fact that it's used in terms of its songliness, it was very, very influential. So that's
yes.
Something. But I've linked the Amazon thing as well. But it's good. It's good to have like a starting point. I've got his Encyclopedia Britannica thing. Dramatica. Encyclopedia Britannica. He doesn't have Encyclopedia.
I think it's also a good place to start, because he will teach people a certain kind of nuance. I think that unfortunately, not through their own fault, but I think a lot of people do lack these days, because he has this kind of characteristic reputation, especially among kind of modern leftists, as this kind of empire tub thumper who just went, you know, empire good, everyone else bad sort of thing. But it's really not what he was like at all. I mean, even his most famous, you could argue it's a pro-empire poem, the White Man's Burden. It's actually a very, very nuanced poem that is really up to interpretation in a lot of ways. You know, he wasn't a stupid man, and he definitely had a sense of where things were headed, even in the late sort of 1800s when everything seemed to be going well. He could see that we were heading into an age of kind of bureaucracy and growing government and sort of looming tyranny. And he's constantly warning about it, you know, and constantly warning the Britons to sort of watch where they tread and never become sort of arrogant about their position in the world. Because when you're the world, I'm sure as many Americans are beginning to realize, when you're the world hegemon, even if things are bad at home, really everything seems like it's going to be all right. You know, how could you possibly lose your position at the head of the world? But things can change very, very quickly. So,
well, shall we get to some of the poetry you've picked out before we run out of time? not to upend you, because the conversation is very interesting, I think.
Oh no, I think it's fine. I think we've got plenty of time, really. The first poem you brought up, I believe, would you like to go through the Ballad of the White Horse, or yes, the canto? I believe it is by Ezra Pound. I think it's the one you mentioned about usury, basically. So
yes, well, I'll start with the Ballad of the White Horse, because it's an important one. Because yes, it's, I mean, so first of all, it's an Arthurian legend, basically, in the form of a poem, and it was written by G.K. Chesterton in 1911 after he went around and did a lot of research. Although, as he says in the prefatory note, it's not really meant to be historical. There are obvious liberties taken in terms of, you know, character and what people were doing and such. But it's not meant to be about history. It's about the struggle to maintain England as its inhabitants would like it. It's one of the things as well. But for us, I think that is why it should be a more respected work, I think, on the right, because it's obviously set at a time when the Danes are invading England, and King Alfred is struggling against them but not doing particularly well, and this is symbolized by the Uffington White Horse, which I'm sure everybody knows, you know, the big white horse which is carved into the side of a hill near Uffington, it's mentioned in the poem that during the reign of the Danes in that area, it has become overgrown with weeds and shrubs and left to rot, really. This poem did come to mind during the degradations of early 2020, when somebody put some sort of BLM graffiti on the white horse, you know, which I think was quickly cleaned off, but still, it struck me as a particularly low time for the British Isles. As mentioned in this poem, and now it's not hugely long. It doesn't take long to read it. It's 2,400 lines, which is not, you know, it's not some massive poetic tome sort of thing. But it's as a poem goes, it's fairly long. So I don't have time to go through the whole lot of it and the story it tells. I just want to draw attention to a particular part at the end of Book One, in which Alfred, his armies are being scattered. His country is being ravaged and looted and laid low by the Danes, and he seems totally lost. He doesn't really know what to do. And he is visited by an apparition of the Virgin Mary. And at first, the first time you read this, you think, oh, here we go. You know, it's going to be the classic, you know, sort of Deus Ex Machina, or, you know, what is she going to do? Is she going to tell him that, you know, is she going to give him some prophecy or something? But instead, she chides him, first of all, and then tells him that it's actually not going to get better. Things are actually going to get worse. But I won't say any more yet. I'll just read from the section. So it's a bit difficult because the stanzas aren't numbered. But I'll go from just the stands are above the one you've got there, so it's where it says "are written" on the sky. I'll go from I think just one above that. Let me see. Sorry, get my own notes here. It's just a giant column of text on my screen for taking me a sec to get it. He sees the Virgin Mary and he says, "Mother of God," the wanderer said, "I am but a common king, nor will I ask what saints may ask to see a secret thing. The gates of heaven are fearful gates, worse than the gates of hell. Not I would break the splendors barred, or seek to know the thing they guard, which is too good to tell. But for this earth most pitiful, this little land I know, if that which is forever is, or if our hearts shall break with bliss, seeing the stranger go. When our last bow is broken, queen, and our last javelin cast, under some sad green evening sky, holding a ruined cross on high, under warm westland grass to lie, shall we come home at last?" And a voice came, human but high up, like a cottage climbed among the clouds, or a serf of hut and croft, that sits by his hovel, fire as oft, but hears on his old bare roof aloft a belfry burst in song. And this is the Virgin Mary speaking now. She says, "The gates of heaven are lightly locked, we do not guard our gain. The heaviest hind may easily come silent and suddenly upon me in a lane. And any little maid that walks in good thoughts apart may break the guard of the three kings and see the dear and dreadful things I hid within my heart. The meanest man in grey fields gone behind the set of sun heareth between star and other star, through the door of darkness full and ajar, the council eldest of the things that are, the talk of the three in one. The gates of heaven are lightly locked, we do not guard our gold. Men may uproot where worlds begin, or read the name of the nameless sin, but if he fail or if he win, to no good man is told. The men of the east may spell the stars and times and triumphs mark, but the men signed of the cross of Christ go gaily in the dark. The men of the east may search the scrolls for sure fates and fame, but the men that drink the blood of God go singing to their shame. The wise men know what wicked things are written on the sky. They trim sad lamps, they touch sad strings, hearing the heavy purple wings, where the forgotten seraph kings still plot how God shall die. The wise men know all evil things under the twisted trees, where the perverse in pleasure pine, and men are weary of green wine and sick of crimson seas. But you and all the kind of Christ are ignorant and brave, and you have wars you hardly win, and souls you hardly save. I tell you naught for your comfort, yea, naught for your desire, save that the sky grows darker yet, and the sea rises higher. Night shall thrice night over you, and heaven and iron cope. Do you have joy without a cause, yea, faith without a hope?" So that just that section there I wanted to read, because it stands out as one of the ultimate kind of unexpected moments in this style of English poetry, because this divine figure appears in the midst of a struggle and says, "Buck up your ideas, because it's not going to get any better. It's going to get worse before things improve, really." And it just strikes me as so relevant to, you know, where we are now, even down to the coincidences of words like cope, as pointed out in the chat. You know, and cope. It's that specific line, "I tell you naught for your comfort, naught for your desire, but the sky grows darker yet, and the sea rises higher." Very powerful couple of lines. Just, you know, and this is a difficult example, obviously, with this kind of crowd, but because I know the Second World War isn't exactly we don't exactly accept the mainstream narrative, but if you forget the sort of the sides for a second, I think a particularly poignant moment of this was right after Crete was taken by the Axis forces in the Second World War. And it was seen as a particularly low moment, and everything seemed to be going wrong for Britain. And the war seemed almost kind of hopeless at that point. And on that particular day, the headline of the Times, the Times newspaper, instead of a kind of leading front page, it was just replaced with this verse. That's all they had. It was just this. I mean,
different times.
Different times, yeah, exactly. Different Britain.
doesn't that speak to the fact that you had a people who you could basically turn to and go, it's bad.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't, because I mean, now all anyone is used to is constantly being told that everything is good and everyone's winning all the time. You know?
Yeah, but I would say in that kind of sense as well, there's almost, maybe I'm completely wrong on this, and that's not to say that there wasn't at any point a tradition of tragedy, but I almost get a hint of almost like self-awareness from this. It's sort of in the same way that Carlyle in certain places seems kind of out of place, because he has taken something that, you know, for him was the norm in, you know, the 1860s or the 1870s at that period, but seemed absurd to him. And he decided to show the absurdity through, you know, blowing it up 20-fold so that it seemed like utter nonsense. It would have been completely ridiculous at the time to read it. But now, looking back on what he's written, it feels like he's writing it for us.
Yeah.
Because he's showing how something, you know, a century and a half ago that took as a norm became something that we now understand as this sort of absurd fallacy of liberal democracy or whatever it is. I get a similar sort of sense mm-hmm. here.
I just like to point out also how incredibly metal some parts of these
are.
The
drinking blood of gods or whatever else.
Yeah, yeah. But the men that drink the blood of God go singing to their shame. It just says, where the forgotten seraph kings still plot how God shall die. The wise men all know evil things under the twisted trees.
It's so much better, though, than something like some pithy social commentary thing on, like, exactly. Oh, here's why the left aren't tolerant. It's like, no, here are the real problems in the world, and we will describe them through the language of glory and greatness tragedy.
It's such a thing. It's just exactly. I'm going to talk about in like childish form in these really hackneyed waves about immigrants breathing diesel fumes. And like G.K. Chesterton's here, and I'm like, I'm talking about how fallen angels plot the death of the Lord.
Exactly. This is a big thing. I think is that, you know, I'm always telling people who are into the arts or into poetry or literature on the dissident right is, for God's sake, don't write quote based poems. Don't make based art as such. Just get to the heart of the matter in the most powerful and inventive way you possibly can. Yeah,
truly, like, good art will be based by default.
Yes.
Exactly. It's not something you have to consciously work in. It's something that will become apparent if the work is good enough.
Yeah, the best art kind of interfaces with or amplifies reality, and reality is based.
No, Michelangelo painted the roof of the Sistine Chapel and thought, oh my god, people are going to put so many trad fucking montages of this on Twitter, bro. I'm going to get mad clout.
Exactly. Don't pander, you know.
The scale here is so epic, like unapologetically epic, though.
Yeah.
It's almost like kind of almost like a poetry version of Wagner.
It is anti-modern in every sense. Yes. I mean, this is something me and you were talking about for different reasons earlier on this evening, that if we were to be honest with ourselves and really put forward what we see as a positive vision in plain English, it would be illegal. It would be seen as some form of radical manifesto and it would be banned.
Yeah.
However, I wonder if, you know, harking back to heroic and epic traditions of poetry might be a way where you can actually deal with the seriousness, the real sort of demonstration of political will in the world, and some of the, shall we say, the return of history in a certain sense could actually maybe be dealt with in poetry without you getting arrested instantly.
Absolutely. I think that genuinely is the way forward, is to, and I've been saying this for a while, the dissident right needs to cultivate some kind of academy of its own, whether it's informal or formal, that is capable of helping young artists hone their skills to really be the top of their game, to be able to produce works like this. Things that aren't, you know, based in the short term sense, things that aren't just going to look, you know, horribly out of date in 2 months, but things that really get to the heart of the matters that we're dealing with. Well, you know, this is like this poem, it's all about It's all about triumph in the face of the absolute worst adversity when your country is being overrun and trashed by foreigners. You know, I failed to see how there could be a more relevant piece of art to us today.
No, exactly. You can then be the chair of the poetry possession and the Gotha and, you know, Chester and Sweet at the Carlisle Institute when that's all set up.
I relish the day. I relish the day it comes, but yes.
Well, to get to it as well, the second one, the second poem you brought forth to us is a piece by Ezra Pound.
If I get spicy.
Yes.
Well, I had to put this one in because I admit I am pandering. It's a crowd favourite for obvious reasons. And obviously it's part of the cantos, which were a kind of large series of poems by Ezra Pound that are collated together. I just want to ask, how much time do we have left to go? Just
half
to judge.
Okay, at most, I say.
Okay, I'll say what I was going to say then. So Ezra Pound is part of a particular group of poets. I would put Eliot in there with them, the American poet Robinson Jeffers, all these various kind of poets, perhaps D.H. Lawrence as well, who were actually deeply reactionary people. Or at least deeply upset with liberal, democratic, consumerist society and sought radical solutions to it. And because they were poets, because they were writers, they consciously kind of crafted a modernist aesthetic, and they broke with traditions in order to preserve them, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And I think a great problem and one of the great sad ironies of the last 100 years is that modernism and postmodernism and all the things that came after were basically just used as acid to pour on what was left of Western art. But it was formulated by people that were deeply reactionary and wanted to regenerate Western society back into something great.
I think of Wyndham Lewis, who was, of course, an associate of Ezra Pound at the time, I believe. You know, he engaged in reactionary thought through things like rejections of democracy, rejections of consumerism, even down to really small stuff like rejecting the notion of the sort of plebeian holiday.
Yeah.
That, you know, the travelling in and of itself through technology and, you know, the fact that we'd made all these different states safe through the empire, that it became just a kind of novelty that people did on a long weekend.
Yeah.
And that, in that same sense, he was essentially disregarded because his reactionary sort of political views were expressed through Sorrel and syndicalism, which are now these old dead ideas. And if anyone talks about syndicalism, they'll maybe mention the fact that, like, oh, well, isn't that what Mussolini used to read? And it's all old and fuddy-duddy. But
I thought we're an autonomous collective.
Yes. But within, you know, as I'd imagine from you find from Pound's poetry, within Wyndham Lewis's stuff that isn't even necessarily his fiction writing, which I suppose is probably dripping in the same themes as well, it's just not my forte. But in his non-fiction stuff, like The Art of Being Ruled, through and through there's reactionary themes that we should really go back and pick up on. But as you said, because they are associated with modernism and consequently postmodernism, and people will just think that they are some, you know, connection to the Fabians or this or that group of the Tory party during the interwar period. It's all guff. So, well, no, because they are going to great lengths to look back on the things that we too are doing the same with, and even that in and of itself should be of interest to us.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's also important to remember that the modernists as a whole were really at the face of a struggle against what they saw as a rotten society. And when somebody is fighting a war, when somebody is in battle, they may do things that you don't necessarily approve of in normal times. You know, they will act in ways that maybe you wouldn't expect, or they might be a bit caustic to talk to, you know. So that's what people have to keep in mind. I mean, They weren't, remember that these people weren't, you know, like modern right wing Twitter accounts. You know, they weren't there to just produce sort of based sound bites. They were they were trying to kick Western society back into gear via the medium of art. Mm. And it's something that, you know, maybe we could say, well, they ended up failing, but they still produced a great number of great works, you know. I did a stream with John Dee on AA's channel last year about The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot. And, you know, he also did the Four Quartets and these kind of great philosophical meditations on what had become of Western society and how it had kind of lost its center, you know, and how everything seemed to be falling apart, to use that line of Yeats. But anyway, let's move on to this Ezra Pound canto. And I want to just point out at the end, there is a note that Ezra Pound has helpfully left in, which will be of interest to the economically minded, yes. Which says, usury, a charge for the use of purchasing power levied without regard to production, often without regard to the possibilities of production, hence the failure of the Medici Bank. I know that you two are far more economically well-read than I am. I don't know if you can provide any extra context there.
He's basically talking about the irresponsible use of finance without any further repercussion as to whether or not that finance itself is used for any great use, as it were. They are, yeah. You know, he's sort of seeing that the, maybe we'll get more of a feel of this during the poem itself, but that usury generally, in his view that he's talking about here, is funding consumption, not production.
Yeah, it's also talking about the fact that it's, you know, corrosive, leads to collapse, leads to things not being produced. It's generally, his tone here is that it's parasitic, even this little note.
Well, also the fact that hence the failure of the Medici Bank. That's him basically going like proto-Rothschild stuff, which I know Ezra Pound has some interesting things to say. If I remember correctly, he may have been involved in the early English mystery group that got the Protocols of Zion printed in the 20s in the UK press.
I don't know if he was involved with that, but he was involved with social credit and the attempts to build an economic system independent of financial speculation, especially in the wake of the Great Depression. And that's why he ended up in Rome and did broadcasts on behalf of Mussolini, because he saw the Axis cause as a crusade against a certain economic way of life dominated by a certain ethnicity, and I won't say any more than that.
We literally have a poem on screen about usury, so I don't think we need to say much
well,
else.
It's interesting though, because I've been reading Bernard Dietz's book Neo-Tories, which is a sort of investigation of the more loyalist hardcore sect of the Conservative Party during 1929 to 1939. And there was constant reference to Ezra Pound and all these different reading and study groups. They had like this large one that went on for years. It was like a study group on the corporatist economy, or as you're describing, the sort of Italian early fascist economy and all this kind of stuff. So there was definitely very much a lot of links that went back then. And it's interesting to see that, as you're saying, these people who were part of the modernist art scene were very much influential people within society and also within the conservative movement in the UK, and even further, just within the Conservative Party itself.
Yes. He was really somebody who wanted to totally reimagine Western society. In that sense, he wasn't just somebody who wrote poetry as such. In fact, some would say, somewhat controversially, I have thoughts on this that I'll get to another time, but some would say he was actually a better critic of poetry and a better writer about poetry than a poet himself. But anyway, I also just want to provide this poem because it's a good example to prove to people on the dissident right who have this obsession with form, you know, where somebody will see a painting that is modernist in some way, and they'll go, oh, cringe, and then they'll retweet some Twitter account called, you know, Trad Western Art, which exclusively posts like 1890s academic style paintings of 17-year-old girls, you know.
Yes.
That kind of thing.
Roman towel boys, yes.
Yeah. It's a great tragic misunderstanding of art, and you know that I don't want to get
into this now, but... feel something.
Yeah, exactly. Look at the Roman statue. Unless it's a Roman statue or a French academic work from 1890, everything in between that ignored. But only those two things are considered trad to the initial. I don't know why, but it's sad because, you know, if you have a movement claiming to be standing for Western civilization and then you don't have any real grasp of Western art or Western style, you know, form is less important than the basic content of the work from this perspective. You know, this is a poem using very little in the way of poetic conventions. It's not rhymed. It's not really metered. And it jumps all over the place, but the message is very powerful because it's like a kind of meditative hymn, you know. But the point is, it can be a great poem, and it doesn't have to rely on traditional form. And I'm somebody who is a great devotee of form in poetry, but I don't think you should be limited to it. I do think that you should take advantage of the 20th century, if you like.
The remit of postmodern traditionalism.
Yeah,
exactly.
Ancient methods and values reinforced through modern Machiavellian methods.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm going to have a go at reading it. I will warn people: it's chock full of words in foreign languages and foreign names. I will probably bug them up terribly, but. Nevertheless, I will try. And also, I can't hold a candle to the Ezra Pound reading of the poem because he had a voice and a way of singing poems that I really can't do. But anyway, Usura. With Usura hath no man a house of good stone, each block cut smooth and well-fitting, that design might cover their face. With Usura hath no man a painted paradise on his church wall, harpes et luth, or where virgin receiveth message and halo projects from incision. With Usura seeth no man Gonfaga his heirs and his concubines. No picture is made to endure nor to live with, but is made to sell and sell quickly. With Usura, sin against nature, is thy bread evermore of stale rags? Is thy bread dry as paper, with no mountain wheat, no strong flour? With Usura the line grows thick. With Usura is no clear demarcation. And no man can find sight for his dwelling. Stonecutter is kept from stone. Weaver is kept from his loom. With Usura, wool comes not to market. Sheep bringeth no gain with Usura. Usura is a murrain. Usura blunteth the needle in the maid's hand and stoppeth the spinner's cutting. Pietro Lombardo came not by Usura. Duccio came not by Usura. Nor Pia della Francesca. Zwan Bellin not by Usura. Nor was La Calunnia painted. Came not by Usura Angelico. Came not Ambrogio Pleiades. Came no church of cut stone side. Adamo me fecit. Not Usura by San Trofim. Not by Usura Saint Hilaire. Usura rusteth the chisel. It rusteth the craft and the craftsman. It gnaweth the thread in the loom. None learneth to weave gold in her pattern. Azure hath a canker by Usura. Cramoisi is embroidered, emerald findeth no memling. Usura slayeth the child in the womb, it stayeth the young man's courting. It hath brought palsy to bed, lieth between the young bride and the bridegroom, contra naturam. They have brought whores for Eleusis. Corpses are set to banquet at behest of Usura. So there you go.
A very good reading. It's very clear what he means by... A lot of what he's saying is he's based in saying that, you know, money men, especially money lenders with interest, don't make art. In fact, they corrode it. They corrode production. They corrode everything.
There is an element of Carlyle. I would imagine this must be in some way inspired by him because I'm reminded of him, you know, writing in full capital letters like, you know, cursed mammon, cursed mammonism. And then he'll go on a rant for like 3 pages about how... Because there is mammonism, there is an obsession with money and wealth and material.
There's something of
literally everything is ruined.
Yeah.
The crafts are ruined. The arts are ruined. even the sausages are ruined by mealy-mouthed men like
exactly.
Bobus Higgins, the sausage maker.
I always think of this poem when thinking about Goislop and, you know, all the...
It is.
You know, it's Goislop and Yeezy trainers.
My bread dry as paper. No mountain wheat, no flour. Yeah.
Yeah, very Azura bringeth forth the soy.
Yes, it does. I mean, you know, I agree with your point about Carlyle, and I think that Ezra Pound and Thomas Carlyle had very similar personalities in terms of a kind of great unrest with the way things were going, and this need to kind of scream from the top of the bell tower, you know, at what was happening. There definitely is some kind of connection between the two you see in the work. I mean, even when he's writing prose essays, Ezra Pound does that kind of Carlylean thing with the capitals, you know, where he says, you know, don't do this and don't do that and make sure we do, you know, always kind of stressing things and ranting and, you know, always kind of high energy, whatever he does, yeah. Which
it's
I think is
the,
good.
It's the Shaman.
Never boring.
Yes, it
Thomas
is.
777. Yeah, exactly.
I was going to say, it is very Thomas 777.
If only there was a few, like, Death to Ukraine, 788.
well, basically him saying, you know, contra naturum, you know, counters to nature, usury is unnatural, you know, it slayeth the young man's courting, it slayeth the child in the womb. I mean, it's all very... very prophetic.
Our corpses are set to banquet. That's the one that got me.
Yeah.
it's very, there are very obvious connections with the modern world, aren't there? With everything that we're living through, you know?
He's basically describing in prose the corrosive effect of like modern global finance. You know, yes. There's no craftsman, the chisel ruster.
We don't make anything anymore.
Yeah, it gnaws the thread from the loom. No one has any skills. He's basically just describing that.
It really speaks to me the parts about, you know, the everything being robbed of everything else, because all I think about whenever I look at any kind of news or read about any of this, all the kind of money markets that drive this country, it's like none of this is real. This is all just like none of this exists. This is all just like numbers on a screen. You know, it's all hypothetical until it actually hits you and turns out. Of course, it always just gets worse. You know, Essentially, it's not real until. Oh yeah, by the way, it's going to get worse again.
It's not real until it's an excuse for more money to be pilfered from us.
Yes, terrible. I mean,
when was this written? By the way, I've just.
The cantos were written between about 40 years. I'll have to look it up specifically.
I'll do some quick live researching here.
So it looks like it was written sometime in the 1930s. Yes, right. 1937. Yep.
37. A good year, a good vintage. this kind of thing. I don't imagine that poem could be written post 1945. Put it that way.
No, but it is one of his more popular poems. Yes. So it has. I mean, the fascinating thing about all these people, you know, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, Wyndham Lewis, is that the academy and the regime can't let them go because they're just too important. You know, that you can't just skip over them and go, oh, they were a bunch of fascists. You know, we won't talk about them because then you wouldn't have anything to stand on. You know, even now, if you're going to do a degree in English literature or something, you will have to encounter these people at some point. You can't forget that T.S. Eliot existed, you know, sort of thing. Ezra Pound had such an influence on art in that century and such an influence on the people around him that you can't ever forget his name or the things he wrote. Even if you're utterly beholden to the ideas of the current regime, you can't ignore these people. Their place is too great, you know.
Well, let's have
so
a look.
There is a weird irony.
If you go to the 1930s here, what do they even have? Ezra Pound.
They do have a Hilaire Belloc one.
All right.
There's D.H. Lawrence as well. W.Y.B. Yeats. I'm sure the European jungle.
Yes.
Well, this is the strange thing, because the regime doesn't ignore them. It doesn't unperson them. But I think, like Bowden said, you don't have to ban books when 40% of the population can't read them anyway.
Well, yeah, I would imagine that there are many a university class where that Ezra Pound poem is read, and the connection is not a discussion on finance specifically, but about capitalism. About consumerism. Yeah. And it will be quoted upon layer and layer of Marxist framing. I mean, I've made the point so many times, and I might as well make it here as well, that, you know, we see nowadays, what's his face, Calvin Robinson, run around for GB News, look at me, I'm the based mulatto, but also Enoch Powell was a Sevenat.
Yeah.
And it's now that you can recognise Enoch Powell, and you can recognise Enoch Powell as an opponent to immigration, but you can't recognise him as someone who believed in an exclusive British identity based on ethnicity.
Yes.
Yes. And I think the other great problem is that all of the university academics that are being trained to go through this stuff and to kind of be the custodians of it they have no independent agency. They are utterly deracinated, fungible people who just exist in the university space. They do nothing of consequence. They produce nothing, and they don't really have any connection with this. To them, it's just a job. To them, it's just something they have to write essays about to get paid.
Other academics are going to buy it, so it doesn't need to be marketable.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And the other thing is as well that, just to follow up your point there, a lot of this comes down to, you know, basically Derrida and the kind of the whole structuralist thing where the author doesn't exist, there's only a text, you know? So if you had been in 1930 and tried to argue that Shakespeare was talking about, you know, homosexuality and the rise of fascism, they would have said, well, obviously not, because that obviously isn't apparent, and the other thing didn't exist in his time. But post the 60s, you can do that, because there is only the text and your interpretation of it. The author doesn't matter. The author is dead. The author is a dead white male with reactionary opinions who can be disregarded as a stooge and an idiot. You know, all you have is their text, and you can interpret whatever you want from that. That is the real legacy of the post-war academic era, and it's why they can kind of lubricate these things so that you can take somebody like Carlyle or Wyndham Lewis and almost just look at them neutrally and kind of disregard them, and look at them through purely sort of non-harmful lenses.
Yes, I'm reminded of the. Oh, it's the Jonathan Bowden lecture on the New Left, and he's talking about, you know, desacralize, depersonalize, detach, and then basically destroy.
Well, that's how they try and teach Schmidt in, like, if you do a degree, like a proper political science degree that still exists at like Oxford or Cambridge, they have to teach you Schmidt. They do it in such a way that they try and make like neutral liberal position Schmidt, and it completely destroys any kind of impact it would have or what he's actually trying to say.
I actually can't believe that I read a certain Canadian man's Twitter feed the other day, and he literally said, going to use reactionary thinkers to bolster my understanding of liberal democracy. Which is word for word like the heading from The Challenge of Carl Schmitt that has essays from like Slavoj Žižek in it about literally how they're going to use the friend-enemy distinction to reinforce a liberal democratic framing when those people themselves are like weird socialists of some variety.
Yes.
It's great.
I mean, I did English literature at the sixth form level, and it was just people being encouraged to have any take they wanted on any text. So, you know, there were these kind of utterly dull, sort of pretentious, sort of lefty types who wanted to talk about how, you know, the proto-feminism in Shakespeare and all this kind of thing. And they could do it. You know, there was no resistance to that. It was just that's what good academia is now.
Well, yeah, as soon as you smash the sort of taboo of treating both the work and the writer behind it with any semblance of respect, it's fair game not just to reinterpret it, but you're actually almost incentivized to come up with the most novel, the most extreme, and the most radical new interpretation.
Yeah, the text belongs to you, and you stand out by destroying it as much as possible.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. It's, it's absolutely of a travesty. I mean, somebody in chat has wondered about the fact that now academia is just a job. And I think there is something to that, because prior to the modern age, you basically had works which were, you know, known throughout the whole of the society. I mean, even in ages where most people couldn't read, I know that, for example, one of the reasons that Don Quixote became such a popular work throughout all of Europe was because it would be read aloud in taverns in the evening, you know? Like it was sort of like going to watch a sitcom, an episode of a sitcom. You know, somebody would stand up in the pub in Spain or wherever, and they would read a chapter of Don Quixote, and everyone would sort of laugh and enjoy it, and it would be part of the entertainment. In the same way that Shakespeare's plays, the majority of people that saw those plays weren't, you know, elite with an education in the arts. They were just plebs who paid a shilling to come and see a play. You know. Because you know, not only is Shakespeare one of the greatest, you know, kind of poet, philosophers, come playwrights who ever lived, but he was able to communicate to an audience of Englishmen, really, just average Englishmen who, you know, you didn't need a specific requirement to understand it, and that's how these things would pass into common memory. You know, until not long ago, it was still very common for, you know, you could go to some sort of, you know, working class estate in Manchester or something. There would be people there who still remembered huge chunks of poetry and of Shakespeare plays from when they were in school. You know, I mean, this is a point I actually meant to make earlier on when we were talking about the curriculum, is that when you go back to, say, the Victorian style of teaching, which wasn't perfect, but one of the hallmarks of that was that children would be forced to learn poetry by heart. They would have to, in order to pass that particular class, you would have to learn certain poems. And what this did is it was an honest way of teaching, because some kid might not be emotionally mature enough to understand all these poems that people have written in his language. But if you make him learn it, one day he will get mature enough or have an experience where all of a sudden it'll make sense. He'll understand what all these poets are talking about, you know, in some way, and it'll be there ready for him. It'll be in his head. You know, the lines will come forth. The power of it, the explanatory sort of cathartic power of great English poetry will then be realized. Whereas now, you know, I mean, we read that whole thing about, you know, we're going to teach people how to be appreciative and how to be self-expressive. It's just waffle. None of that means anything. You know, you either engage with the great pieces of poetry that your ancestors have given you, or you're forcibly detached from it. And right now we have the latter. And, you know, it's, well, you know, which one do you want?
Very, very powerful words, I think. Is there anything else you want to say before I do kind of our closing shilling? Or
Well, I would recommend everybody buy the Imperium Anthology. I'm somebody who has a huge amount of books on poetry, and I find it very useful because we haven't just put in all the old favorites. You know, there are ones in there that you won't have seen before. I promise that I think deserve some light. And it's just a very well-edited book, and it's very well put together. I'm not praising myself there. I'm praising the people that literally put it together. I'm talking about the people that actually set the physical book up. It's extremely well done. It's crammed a lot into a very small space in a very effective way. And it will be good to see people using it. And also, I will add that I don't get any royalties for it. I was given a fee to write the introduction, and that's it. So This is not me shilling something that I will make money off.
Oh, no,
I think it's just, yeah.
It's good. It's a good thing to have. And you've mentioned other books. I put them in the chat. I'll put a pinned comment later, basically with the links to the poems and the links to the book, which is already in the description, and a link to a couple of the other book you mentioned as well. I will say that you are still on social media, just about. You're on Twitter. You are still kind of on YouTube, although I know you've been very busy recently. But I'll put those two in there if people do want to follow you.
I will be making videos again very soon. In fact, I'm working on one tonight after the stream. I will just add as well. I know that there are some people in these circles in general who kind of have a sneer at it. They go, well, poetry is not really for me. You know, it's all a bit arty or whatever. And I just want to say, remember the point that was made at the beginning. Poetry isn't just some diversion to occupy time. The reason that you don't appreciate it or can't is because you have been forcibly detached from it. And the regime has succeeded in separating you from the lifeblood of the people you come from. And I think it's really your duty to try and reconnect that link, because if you don't, you're giving up ground to the regime. I think far too many on the right are willing to just give up the arts, you know, whatever, let the left have all the books and all the music and all the paintings and all the sculptures or whatever. Don't do that. Never give up ground to the enemy if you can avoid it, you know. Engage with this, to engage with these things that make the people of this country, the people, the English speaking peoples, to use that phrase, that add that extra level of greatness because of the achievements. You know, people like Shakespeare and various other poets, they're genuinely some of the greatest imaginative people to have ever lived. That's why they're teaching him now in classrooms in Brazil and Nigeria and India and China. You know, that it's because we have in this country one of the greatest dramatic and poetic traditions that has ever been seen. And for God's sake, don't let them take that away from you. That would be what I would end
words
on.
Words to live by.
Yes.
And if you wish to cash in on such an attitude, make sure you're present for Nomos Manchester 2 in partnership with the Mises Institute.
Yes.
On the 27th of May this year, I believe we've sold over a third of the tickets now by a decent margin.
Yes. We can't really announce in what specific capacity, but I will say there is an extremely good chance that Mr. Hatt will be there in some capacity. So
even if I'm not speaking, you can join me at the bar.
We don't have someone to handle proceedings for this evening, so I might actually just ask you right now, would you like to be our MC?
I would love to be the MC. I would relish that opportunity.
Well, there you go. Hopefully there's a few folk buy tickets now because, oh, more Panama hat.
Woo! Yeah. It is good. We do have, we have Nomos 2. It's happening on the 27th of May. And tickets start at about £35 if I flash it up here for people. It's going to be good. We've already sold quite a lot of the tickets and we haven't made many of the announcements yet. So do get in if you can. For those of you who would like to follow our writing, we do have the Anti-Politics Substack, as mentioned at the beginning. If you guys want to keep seeing this kind of content, do drop a like, do subscribe, and do comment. I know it's gay to say all that stuff.
Do the algorithm.
I'm afraid the algorithm gods do need appeasing in some way. We are still monetized. The best recurring way you can support us inside the ecosystem is through channel membership, which we do have available. Although I am trying to work on a decent kind of recurring way for people to support us that isn't something like Subscribestar, which I find very clunky and has very limited payout windows. I don't want people to essentially waste their money on fees and be in escrow where, we can't really access it. So I'll try and work on some stuff for people because people have expressed quite a lot of desire to help support us in different ways, but have expressed a bit of, disdain for the large cuts that certain services take, which is fine. I understand your I do understand your frustration because I share it. We'll be back on Wednesday with the second part of our Ofcom stream. We did kind of a history of Ofcom last week or the week before. It was the week before last because we had Samuel Gog on. But we'll be doing a follow-up showing some of the functions of Ofcom and also a case study via BitChute of how its powers can destroy your business with the stroke of a pen. So do join us then. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Panama Hat.
Thank you for everyone else turning up and having a listen along. Yes. I know this is a bit maybe a bit of an alternative stream from our usual stuff, but I think that this stuff is just as, if not more important, given how little discussion there is. So please do support Panama Hat. And if you pick up the book from Imperium Press, do make sure to know that we sent you.
Yes.
Good night.
Yes, indeed. Bye, everyone.
Yeah, after about every time you've had the